is to live in Minnesota.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. I'm Chantel Sings. Ramadan, the Islamic month of fasting and reflection, is underway, and Muslims around the world, including here in Minnesota, are observing the holy days. In today's program, we'll hear how Muslim communities across the state are celebrating and finding hope this Ramadan. We'll also look at how ongoing federal immigration operations are affecting renters and landlords, and what local and state leaders are doing in response. But first, here are some of the top stories from around the state. After months of secrecy, we now know Google is the tech giant behind the controversial data center planned for Hermantown. Google's reveal comes after it announced plans for a second data center in Pine Island last week. Community members are concerned about negative environmental consequences, as well as a lack of transparency in the process. County officials say they were required to sign non-disclosure agreements to negotiate the Hermantown Center with developers, a highly unusual step that kept Google's name out of public view. Meanwhile, South Metro suburb of Eagan recently instituted a one-year ban of any new data centers. Minnesota's dairy industry says small farms need help.
Every time a cow is milked in Minnesota, it creates a ripple effect.
Garrett Luthens, president of Minnesota Milk, testified in support of expanding financial relief to new dairy farms in the state. The proposal opens loan applications to dairy farms that started operations during 2022 and meet other qualifications. Supporters say updating the legislation is a targeted fix for one of Minnesota's key industries. Go to the state's website to find out if you qualify for the Dairy Assistance, Investment, and Relief Initiative. It is open for applications through March 19th. A new bill would let prosecutors file felony charges against adults who build trust with a student for the purpose of exploitation, even if no sexual contact has happened yet.
Due to the years of grooming, I believe that I was an active participant in my abuse and that I had caused it to happen.
Survivor Hannah Lopresto says her band teacher started grooming her when she was in 10th grade and continued through graduation.
It was years of psychological manipulation that harmed my understanding of intimate relationships, my own value, and my ability to trust others.
Prosecutors currently have to wait until abuse occurs to file charges. Supporters say this bill will help stop abuse earlier and prevent long-term harm. The bill would also expand training for mandatory reporters and prohibit adults from being alone with students on field trips. The Mankato City Council passed an emergency ordinance Tuesday night that bans law enforcement agents from concealing their faces. Effective immediately, officers cannot wear masks, must use body cameras when possible, and notify the city ahead of operations. Mankato's city attorney says,
just because they're a federal officer doesn't mean that they can't violate one of our city codes. We're not telling them they can't, you know, execute that warrant. We're telling them that they can't have a face covering on.
The new law is in effect until April 24th and could become permanent then. After more than 7 weeks of federal immigration operations in Minnesota, which followed high-profile fraud allegations involving the Somali community, Muslims across the state are now observing Ramadan, the holy month of fasting and reflection. Reporter Jose Orzoria tells us how Ramadan's message of patience, resilience, charity, and unity is resonating with Minnesota's Muslim community.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
Ramadan is the ninth lunar month. It's a month that Muslims believe that God sent the last revelation, the Quran.
Dr. Tamim Saidi is the resident scholar with the Islamic Resource Group, an organization that seeks to bring people of all faiths together by building bridges of understanding through conversation and dialogue. He describes the importance of this mission, especially during Ramadan.
To be able to go and speak with people about what Islam is, who are the Muslims, what is Ramadan, what do Muslims really believe? Because there's a lot of misunderstanding and misperception about Islam and Muslims.
This year, Minnesota's Muslim community entered Ramadan, the sacred period of fasting, prayer, and reflection, with the echoes of Operation Metro Surge still reverberating throughout the state. Dr. Tamim describes the significance Ramadan has in Islam.
Muslims consider it to be a month of mercy, a month of forgiveness, a month of protection. And this is a month of generosity also. Pretty much every mosque has a fundraiser.
And to those that observe the holy month, Ramadan carries a singular spiritual purpose: to realign the soul.
The purpose of Ramadan is to achieve what is called in Arabic taqwa. And taqwa is translated as a God consciousness, achieving piety and righteousness, essentially being conscientious of God.
Lasting 29 or 30 days, based on the lunar cycle, each year from sunup till the sun drops below the horizon, Muslims collectively enter a time of restraint and remembrance, abstaining from food and drink, eliminating distractions, focusing instead on prayer, reflection, and charity. Dr. Tamim.
Ramadan is supposed to be a holistic fast of the entire body, not just the stomach. So the tongue is supposed to fast from saying anything they're not supposed to say. The eyes are supposed to fast by not looking at anything you're not supposed to look at. The hands are supposed to fast. And even the heart and the mind is supposed to fast by not thinking about what we're not supposed to be thinking.
During the sacred time of prayer, reassessment, and charity, the imam is the person who leads the prayer and acts as the spiritual anchor of the community, helping the congregation to enter into the daily rhythm of worship during Ramadan.
My dear brothers and sisters in Islam, we're thankful to Allah. We ask Allah to guide us to the results that we desire, inshallah, that we please Him, that we be pleasing unto Him, inshallah.
At Mosque Al Maun, Imam Makram guides the congregation through that rhythm, step by step, day by day, a community fasting together and praying together.
Suhoor is the morning meal that we do before the prayer time. So it really prepares us to meet of the day. And as the Prophet, peace be upon him, Muhammad, said that there's a blessing in taking the suhoor. It's a blessing in that morning meal.
It's the only meal until sundown.
And then we would have what's called iftar. Well, that's the breaking of the fast. Traditionally, it's dates, but it should be something that is natural from the earth that we would take to break our fast.
And this culminates with a joyous gathering.
And then we would generally pray our Maghrib prayers, our sunset prayers. Then we take a meal, just a normal meal. It's the iftar time. It's generally a joyous occasion. It's a lots of, you know, festivities. People are celebrating. And we have our fifth prayer of the day, Isha, which is the night prayer. And then beyond that, we have what's called Tarawih prayers.
Remember, we are there in surged operations because of the largest fraud scheme in American history. We had people stealing from taxpayers.
Every rationale the administration has offered for this surge is really a pretext. The government has said the purpose of the surge is to fight unauthorized immigration, yet Minnesota ranks 28th among
Alex
all
was
states.
A lawful gun owner, but he was immediately criticized for that when, in fact, the video showed very clearly, because eyes don't lie.
But the fact of the matter is, they left us with deep damage, generational trauma. They left us with economic ruin in some cases.
An important aspect of Ramadan is that it's a time of reflection, allowing Muslims to build self-discipline and spiritual connections for the year to come. Dr. Tamim describes how Operation Metro Surge has had a lasting impact on Minnesota's Muslim community.
They also target just because they look like they might be immigrants, blacks and browns, which is, you know, in my opinion, you know, it's nothing short of being racist and ethnically profiling people because of those. And I know for sure there's some people who are not coming to the mosque during this time. And they, you know, so that is a challenge.
Imam Makram points out that the ramifications of Operation Metro Surge have been significant.
Folks have been fearful, you know, to shop as they normally would. That has had a direct hit to businesses. We're seeing a lot more people who normally don't need support in need of support right now.
Minnesota is home to a large, diverse Muslim community, deeply woven in the fabric of the state. Dr. Tamim points out that gaining knowledge and familiarity of Muslim culture and traditions reinforces the sense of community among all Minnesotans.
When you combine fear with ignorance, that leads to hate and prejudice, right? So knowing someone, knowing something, knowing a Muslim, knowing something about their faith and practices, it breaks that cycle of fear plus ignorance leading to hate and prejudice.
Imam Makram finds hope in how the broader non-Muslim Minnesota community has rallied to support Muslims in Minnesota.
They are observers. While we're inside praying, they stand outside, sometimes in the cold, right? Being another level of support to us, I see hope in that.
Ramadan began in the evening of February 17th and is observed through March 19th. For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
The estimated Muslim population in Minnesota represents about 2% of the state's total population, more than 100,000 people. The community is largely concentrated in the Twin Cities, with roots in Africa, South Asia, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East, plus members of the Nation of Islam and other groups. To help us understand more about how Minnesotans celebrate this month, we are now joined by Huseifa Ahmed, a member of the Lakeville Masjid in Dakota County. This past November, the Lakeville City Council unanimously approved the establishment of the city's first ever mosque. Thank you so much for joining us, Huseifa.
Thank you for having me here.
Tell us about how it was to start the first mosque in Lakeville and how the community is reviewing it.
It's definitely been a big need to have a central location for a lot of the residents in Lakeville. For the Muslim population, for the Muslim community, like the mosque, what we call the masjid, so you might hear that term be thrown around quite a bit, but the masjid serves as one of the biggest anchors for any Muslim community. Like, that's the place where we hold on to our culture, where we hold on to our heritage, where we hold on to our tradition, our practices, our beliefs. I mean, it's natural that once you step outside into the rest of the world, like, it's easy to assimilate and forget a lot of your roots. But the mosque or the masjid kind of acts as that anchor that helps make sure that generation after generation, there's still the flavor of who we are and what we come from.
For listeners who may not be familiar, can you describe what a typical day of Ramadan looks like for Muslims in Minnesota?
Our fasting started about maybe, I want to say 5:20 a.m. And then we'll fast all the way until, I think today it's going to be right around about 6 p.m. So a little over 12 hours without food and not even water. I know that comes as a surprise to many people. It's essentially an opportunity for us to build discipline and self-control and willpower and things like that. You know, it's like a reset. You're at a boot camp where you can prepare yourself for the rest of the year. Every night has been different community gatherings. Ramadan is one of those occasions where people are just inviting all the time. Like, you get so many invitations, you get so many different, oh, please, you know, visit us at our house or come visit us at the mosque. And it's funny because you'll see people come to the mosque in large numbers. But Ramadan helps you connect with a larger community that you didn't know existed. It's a very beautiful thing to kind of just get together and eat and share a meal together.
For people who are not Muslim but want to be supportive, what are some respectful ways they can engage during Ramadan, whether that's at work, in schools, or by visiting a mosque or community event?
There are so many things that can be done to be supportive, but I think the biggest and one of the most important things is just a willingness to be, like, to learn. We have to be able to be comfortable with stepping into what's uncomfortable. You and I are only going to build a bridge and build a connection if I'm willing to step into a space and meet you halfway. If you have friends at school or at work, I just dive into their culture a little bit, dive into their ideas a little bit. And maybe, you know, this is a challenge for some people. I just recommend someone, say, hey, by the way, why don't we fast and then let's go get some food? You know, find a nice Muslim-owned restaurant. I know much of the world around us is specifically trying to target us as a community in Minnesota to kind of divide us and make us scared. But my invitation is always, hey, like, if you know there's a mosque near you, if you know there's a Muslim community center nearby, if you know some Muslims, why not spend some time, get to know them? And you'll realize very quickly, they're just like your regular everyday neighbors. They're people who are nice. They're people who can crack good jokes. They're people who can have good conversations. They have amazing, delicious food. Sometimes it can be a little spicy, but that's just part of the flavor. So, yeah.
That's all the time we have. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
After the break, how renters and landlords are still feeling the effects of federal immigration operations in Minnesota. This is North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, produced by Ampers, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota. We'll be right back.
Ampers is diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. We are an association of 17 independent community radio stations in Minnesota with over 300,000 listeners. We support our stations through revenue, training, and original news, arts, and cultural programs. Ampers programming is produced for and by the communities in our station's regions and aims to correct narratives about historically underrepresented groups. Check out what we're up to online at ampers.org, on Instagram, and Facebook.
You are listening to North Star Stories. I'm Chantel Sings. Many communities across the state continue to feel the effects of recent federal immigration crackdown. Officials say some families are struggling to keep a steady income and stay current on rent. Several cities are debating temporary eviction moratoriums, while landlords worry about financial strain. Reporter Jamaat Jama has more.
I'm here this evening to ask you once again to take urgent action to protect people in Duluth from federal immigration activity. I urge you to vote for the eviction moratorium resolution. This would provide major temporary relief to those most impacted by the current crisis.
That was a Duluth resident speaking at a recent city council meeting, asking leaders to support an eviction moratorium, which would put a temporary pause on evictions to keep renters housed.
It's not just people in the Twin Cities being affected. It's an important part of our community here in Duluth. We need a full statewide eviction moratorium now.
Across Minnesota, concerns about housing stability are rising as federal immigration enforcement continues. Due to the presence of ICE or Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, community leaders say that some immigrant families, regardless of status, are afraid to leave their homes for work, leading to a loss of steady income. In Duluth, the city council voted 5-4 to postpone a decision on a resolution related to an eviction moratorium. Now, advocates across the state are calling for leadership to step in as the main operation concludes and communities adjust to the impact. Recently, the city of Minneapolis was able to approve $1 million in emergency rental assistance for residents facing eviction.
I am City Council Member Robin Wansley. I represent Ward 2. One of the key effects that we've seen from Operation Metro Surge has been the destabilization of housing conditions. People haven't been able to earn a means to cover their everyday necessities. All of that means is that people don't have the money to pay rent.
This funding is aimed at helping residents cover rent and avoid displacement during this period of instability.
I was very proud to earn a majority of my colleagues' support in getting $1 million towards rental assistance towards Hennepin County with the goal of helping stabilize residents. We are not just talking, we're putting policies in place and we're moving millions of dollars to be responsive to this crisis.
From the council's perspective, rental assistance isn't a cure-all. It works hand-in-hand with an eviction moratorium.
They're complementary. The eviction moratorium is in many ways to stop the bleeding immediately. On the opposite side of that, we know there will be evictions.
Council Member Wansley says that when people are afraid to leave their homes and lose income, it's state and city leadership's responsibility to step in.
The whole purpose of government is to help. And that is the biggest piece of why we've pushed so hard to deliver resources for rental assistance. To push for relief in the form of funding to our small businesses, to make sure that we're extending and expanding legal services.
Opponents of the moratorium say that they don't agree that it's the right solution, arguing that the ripple effects will create financial strain for landlords.
My name is Barbara Monti. I understand that these are times of high emotions, but an eviction moratorium, in my opinion, will hurt more than it will help.
Barbara, who rents properties in the Duluth area, says that during past eviction pauses, she lost substantial income while still being responsible for the cost of maintaining her property.
I'm speaking tonight so that you can hear from someone who currently provides housing to more than 70 renters in Duluth. I have experience from post-eviction moratoriums. I lost thousands of dollars. Affordable housing providers are and will be most impacted if an eviction moratorium is passed.
For Minnesotans navigating housing instability, nonprofit organizations like HomeLine have been an essential source of support.
My name is Eric Hauge, and I'm a co-executive director here at HomeLine. And our main program is a free and confidential tenant hotline that provides legal advice to renters throughout the state.
And the demand for that support is growing.
Our eviction prevention project manually pulls every single residential tenant-landlord eviction filing in the state. And so we track that internally, and we send a multilingual letter to every household that has a filing against them. Last year, we mailed over 25,000 letters. It's the highest filing rate we've seen since our program began.
When tenants contact the HomeLine, they don't just get advice. They're given a roadmap for navigating their housing concerns.
People contact us, leave a message, and then one of our attorneys or tenant advocates will reach out to them and go through what the issue is and then what options there are. Given the sensitive nature of a lot of folks that are in vulnerable positions, it's just heartbreaking, some of the stories that we've heard. It's taken a long time for the state to step up and take action to protect renters.
Ultimately, the Duluth City Council voted against a proposal urging a statewide eviction moratorium, but approved a separate resolution asking the state to provide rental assistance to residents impacted by Operation Metro Surge. And throughout the rest of Minnesota, lawmakers are urging similar measures, introducing bills that would fund rental assistance and expand eviction protections. For North Star Stories, I'm Jama Jama.
The housing crisis in Minnesota was already serious before the federal operation, and advocates now estimate it has added millions of dollars in rent debt and other ripple effects. We're joined now by Cecil Smith, president and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. This nonprofit trade group represents the rental housing industry. Thank you so much for joining us, Cecil.
Thank you, Chantel. It's good to be with you.
Can you walk us through how an eviction moratorium will affect your sector specifically?
Sadly, we have some fairly recent experience with this, with what happened during COVID when there was an extended eviction moratorium in place. What we saw happening was very significant growth in what we call bad debt. It's folks that have been unable to pay. As those balances grew for individual renters, it creates very serious solvency issues. And, you know, the Minneapolis City Council considered what I would say is an eviction moratorium light. They wanted to extend the notice period to 60 days before filing an eviction. And the nonprofit housing sector came in very loudly and said, please don't do this. We're already still trying to recover financially from the COVID experience. There's real concerns about the solvency of housing providers, that they will not be able to pay all of their bills.
It's a ripple effect, it sounds like, on both ends. Advocates argue, though, that pairing a temporary eviction pause with emergency rental assistance can keep both renters and the landlords whole. If the state guaranteed faster, more reliable rental assistance, would you support any kind of short-term eviction pause?
The question premises that the state could guarantee fast and reliable rental assistance. And I think most of us, with our experience with government, fast and reliable and not the synonyms that we generally associate with performance in government assistance programs, especially. For that reason, it's hard to support an eviction pause because we don't think the rental assistance can arrive in a timely fashion. And the other premise to the question is that, right, that there's a need. Our industry actually has sample data. Everybody else is speculating about what the need is. And my members, we have 2,400 members with over 300,000 units of housing across the state. That's nearly half the rental market and certainly almost all of the professionally managed properties in the state. And I polled my board, which has about 40,000 of that 300,000 units. And there are properties where there's been some pockets of challenges, but broadly, rent collections in February were normal. In fact, some portfolios had higher rent collections than February of the previous year.
You know, Cecil, really quick before we run out of time, I just had a quick question about the short-term eviction pause. Is there not a possible way to have a short-term eviction pause fund, emergency fund? But it seems like there should be some funds aside for things like COVID and all of the, you know, things that we have no control over, that some people don't have savings, you know, and some of the property owners just only can bear so much. But it sounds like on both sides, people need to be protected.
That's right. People do need to be protected, both in terms of stable housing operations so that all the residents in a particular property can have safe, well-maintained housing, properly staffed, et cetera. But to your question, we're not very good in our country at planning for bad things happening. In fact, increasingly the way things seem to work in our country is we only respond to things once there's a crisis, and then we start to take action, and then we're scrambling. We don't have the funds set aside. And that's part of the problem that even the legislature is facing right now. And I think that's a much bigger question about, you know, how is government really set up to handle things like this?
Well, Cecil, it sounds like we all have a lot of room for growth on all parts. So that's the main thing. I think that's the biggest lesson here, preparation, and trying to make sure that we look at what has happened in history and try to prepare better for the things that we don't know is going to happen in the future. We appreciate your time, Cecil Smith. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you, Chantel. Thank you for having me, and great conversation.
In other news from across the state, Minnesota officials released a new climate roadmap that aims to cut pollution while protecting health, jobs, and communities. The 2026 Climate Action Framework updates the state's original 2022 plan, moving to 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040, speeding up electric vehicle adoption, cutting emissions from building heat, and investing in infrastructure and disaster response. The plan states that nearly 9 in 10 Minnesota communities already report feeling climate impacts. We are ending today's program by celebrating a new recognition for the state as one of the best places in the country to raise kids. According to a ranking by the online personal finance platform WalletHub, the state is second best in the nation based on 50 measures. Governor Tim Walz says policies like paid family and medical leave, a new child tax credit, expanded access to affordable child care, and strong public schools help families thrive. The report highlights Minnesota's strong health outcomes, high life expectancy, quality public hospitals, and access to parks and recreation that support children's well-being. State officials say this latest ranking adds to a growing list of national recognition for Minnesota's quality of life, economy, and support for children and families. This is it for today's program. If you missed any part of today's newscast, you can find this and past episodes at ampers.org or listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with more stories and voices from the North Star State.
North Star Stories is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, how the annual Ely Film Festival showcases independent films and Indigenous storytelling, and two young Indigenous athletes to watch on the ice. First, producer Chaz Wagner tells us how the Ely Film Festival is drawing filmmakers and movie lovers from across the region to northeastern Minnesota.
A winter tradition in northern Minnesota is bringing independent film and Indigenous storytelling to the area. The annual Ely Film Festival returns this week to the Ely Historic State Theater, drawing filmmakers and movie lovers from across the region. The festival is now into its fourth year, celebrating a broad range of cinema, from feature-length films to shorts, documentaries, and experimental projects.
We have over a third of our films coming from Indigenous filmmakers. Thursday, March 12th is our Indigenous Youth Film Day. We'll be screening a special block called the Bajamoan Shorts, where we'll have over 100 students watch various short films.
That's Ryan Bajan, director of the Ely Film Festival. Organizers say the event is about more than screenings. Pass holders will have chances to engage directly with creators through Q&A sessions, filmmaker meet and greets, and conversations that explore the artistic process and cultural themes behind the work.
Seems kind of wild to come and sit for an entire day and watch a bunch of different film, but the learning that takes place is rapid. We are exposed to so much more than we would get from just our normal TVs and whatever we think we can watch online and stuff.